Time for another look at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife. Larry Mueller here, and my guest, Scott Craven, UW. Gosh, retired UW. That's yes. Hard to say, retired UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist.
Well, it's hard to hear, too, Larry, but yes, for 5-6 days now.
You don't look any different.
Well, I don't feel any different either, and I'm still here in the studio, so I guess I'm not behaving much differently either.
And that's a good thing, and we're glad to have you here, and Scott's going to keep coming. Occasionally, we might run into a problem, but for the most part, he's going to be with us the first Wednesday of every month for as long as possible. So great to have him along. If you have questions for him about wildlife, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. You can also post on my Facebook page, at The Larry Mueller Show. We would love to hear from you. And you've been spending a little time up north. Got any report on the wildlife situation up north?
Well, a little bit of time this past weekend up at the cabin in Price County and roaming around a bit. It's been warm up there, too, very warm.
Yep.
So the water's certainly warmed up. The reproductive season, as it is across the state, is beginning to wind down, but we still had turtles laying eggs in the driveway, so the turtles are still out and about. That's still something to watch out for. The loons seem to be very active, although on our lake they were unsuccessful this year, but so it goes.
So it goes.
And generally speaking, the deer have got their nice bright orange summer coats, and they were out and about along the roadsides, and people were seeing the occasional other member of the wildlife community, but it's a jungle out there.
Yeah.
This hot weather after good spring rains have created quite a splurge of growth, and if my garden here is any indication of what's going on outside or the growth on the prairie, it's almost impenetrable. So visibility of our various wildlife species has declined measurably. So it'll be tough to see some things, but they're certainly out there and active.
They certainly are. I had a situation this morning where Renee, my wife, comes in and says, "There's a rabbit stuck in our fence," and went out, and there was a rabbit stuck in a hole that it had no business trying to get through. And my guess was that when it was little, it was getting through that hole regularly.
And
it was stuck, and so I finally got the clippers and clipped the fence, a couple of strands of the fence, and he went, not too happily on his way. He was still kind of bruised up, but he went on his way.
I'm guessing there's some holes here and there and fences and things that we probably can't get through either anymore, Larry.
Yeah, you got that right. Oh, man. Dan in Partyville has a question or comment for you, so let's go to Dan. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Good.
Great.
Say, I live in Partyville, kind of out in the country, and we've had an inordinate amount of raccoons visiting us this year.
Mm-hmm.
And I've trapped them and taken 6 of them so far and taken them to private land that fellows I know. But there's a really big one coming out that he's not going to fit in my trap. I don't want to shoot him. He comes out between midnight and 3 in the morning. How can I deter him from coming around?
Well, Dan, that is not an easy proposition, and I'm facing the same thing. I was sleeping in the basement last night because it's a lot cooler, but I heard a major ruckus at 2 a.m. Both of the labs went berserk, and I kind of forgot about it and went back to sleep. But I heard about it this morning that at 2 o'clock a big raccoon visited the bird feeders right outside the bedroom window, and I really should have gotten up and done something about it, but I didn't. The bottom line is you can get traps. I mean, if you're committed to live trapping, you can get big, heavy-duty raccoon traps from the Tomahawk Live Trap Company up in Tomahawk. I guess they have an office now in Minocqua.
Minocqua, yes.
That would trap any raccoon that walks the face of the planet, but they're not... They're not inexpensive,
no,
but
they're not cheap.
No, they're not cheap, but you can get a trap that'll catch any size raccoon if you want to do that. Most people, especially, or many people, I should say, in rural areas would kind of turn their other cheek and resort to gunfire if it was one that simply was either too difficult to trap or wouldn't fit in a trap. That's entirely up to you. But in terms of discouraging him, what's he doing?
Well, he's getting in our sunflower feeders. He's getting in some of the bird houses, and he's waking up our two dogs. And we get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to work, and we're tired and cranky. And they're just a nuisance.
Do away with the bird seed, the bird feeders. That's practically all you can do.
That's really all you can do if you feel you can't trap him, don't want to shoot him, then eliminating the source of attraction is the only other alternative. So you have to balance off, gee, do I want to give up the bird feeding right now to let the raccoon get acclimated to doing something else for a living, or is the bird feeding important enough that I'm going to do something with or to the raccoon that I might not otherwise have considered?
Are they habitual? So if we take the bird feeders down, the source of the feed down for, say, a week or two, will they in a month remember that, oh, I can go here, and then they'll come back?
I think that the odds are, with the food supply changing very rapidly throughout the summer, by the time if you took it down for 3 or 4 weeks and the sweet corn is ready within another month or so, as well as other agricultural commodities, I think the coon's going to find something else to do.
Yeah,
but
okay.
I think that's certainly worth a try.
Sure.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Mentioning bird seed, prices on bird seed, sunflower seed is really expensive.
Well, yes, and Dan just mentioned the black oil sunflower seed. I was looking for a bag to stock up as we continue to feed during the summer the other day, and I thought, wow, the first place I went, I think, was $27.99 for a 50-pound bag, and then I went to another spot, and I was looking around in northern Wisconsin. I was up there last week, and I saw it up to as high as $36, $37 for 50 pounds.
That's a lot.
Yeah, I was sort of used to, hey, on sale, $10, $12, not too long ago. So I did a little digging on that with some of the bird feeding supply places and whatnot. I said, what the heck is going on? Well, the issue is that as far as this season is concerned, we're still working on last year's production, of course, but crops did get in late. As everybody knows from the flooding in the news, it's been very wet in the Dakotas. Supply is apparently being held back by some distributors or farmers hoping to capitalize on price increases. There's more demand for sunflower oil, so there are competing uses for the sunflower crop.
Yeah.
And, of course, corn's very high, so a lot of people are planting corn, maybe didn't plant as many sunflowers. Bottom line, the people confided in me that I talked to that their words were little optimism that as the new crop comes on, that prices are going to go down dramatically at the end of the summer, so that people gearing up for fall and winter bird feeding would normally say, oh, big sale on sunflower seeds, it's time to buy a few hundred pounds. It didn't seem very likely that that was going to happen. So what concerned me a little bit is whether or not these high prices, and they're probably close to triple what people were used to paying, whether this is going to have a measurable impact on how much feeding people do. And it's the same thing with corn. You know, a 50-pound bag of shell corn that not too long ago was $3 or $4 is pushing 9 or 10 now.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering, and I think this is one of those things where we turn to the listeners, are people also experiencing that little bit of sticker shock when it comes to wildlife food? And more importantly, has it, or do you think it will, affect your behavior in terms of whether you're doing as much feeding of birds or perhaps other things in the case of maybe feeding deer in the North Country? Is this going to have an impact? And a couple of the stores I talked to said, well, you know, they were consciously not passing on all of the cost increases to the consumer for that very concern.
Yeah.
And anyway, I find that a little bit scary. Not only is it tough to pay more for anything in the current economy, but if it means people change their behavior and bird feeding slows down a little bit, then that's not necessarily a good thing either.
No.
So we'll see if anybody has thoughts on that.
If you have some thoughts on that, you can do it in many ways. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. If you're on our Facebook page, go to the Larry Mueller Show. Let us know if you plan to cut back on your seed feeding of birds or not.
Well, and what I'd planned on doing as a follow-up to that was to recommend to folks to keep their eyes open as the summer progresses. And if prices come down or there are big sales leading into the bird feeding season, that you think about buying
a bunch,
you know, 5 or 6 bags and storing them. The problem there is I talked to our good friend Phil, because as I store seeds over the warm season, I get these little moths in the seed. No matter how you store it, you seem to get these little moths that create kind of a web or network amongst the seeds. And it turns out those are Indian meal moths.
Yes, they are.
The same little meal moths that get into your pasta or grains or whatever in your pantry. And Phil's concern was that there was really relatively little you could do other than if you could freeze the bags or the storage containers below freezing and shock them to kill the eggs or the moth larvae or the moths themselves. Otherwise, he's afraid that some of the seed actually comes to you with the eggs or whatever in the seed already.
Yep.
So it's not your fault, but it makes storing the seed over a long period of time a little tricky. So, folks, be careful. Be careful how you store it if you find a deal on it, because it may not prove to be cost-effective. But there you go.
There you go. And let us know. Go to the Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Tell us if you're going to continue to feed or maybe cut back or eliminate. Bob in Jackson, we are going to you now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning, Larry, and good morning, Scott.
Morning.
Morning.
So, a fishing question, but also just listening to your prior conversation there as far as sunflower seeds, I just remarked over the weekend, we've got some wrens that have taken to building a nest because I haven't filled the sunflower seeder feeder for a couple of weeks. Well, I walk by the thing and hear some cute little wrens. We've got them in a birdhouse that's about 20 yards away from there. And the reason I hadn't put the sunflowers in is I was waiting for sunflowers to be back under 50 cents a pound. And I haven't found any.
Well,
and you just explained why.
Well, I hope I'm wrong, Bob, because, you know, I'm buying this stuff like many people are.
Me
and
too.
I would certainly like to see the price come down, but I didn't get much encouraging information that was going to happen. Certainly not back to the level that we might have been used to a couple of years ago.
Okay. Well, that's my 2 cents. And having taken down my first Social Security check last month, I probably will, unfortunately, cut back a little. I'll still have to get some sunflower seeds out this fall and into the winter for sure, because we get cardinals and what have you like crazy, and I just like them too much. I'm going to have to spend a little money, but
okay.
I'm going to be back a little. So anyway, Scott, here's the question. So last week I'm up fishing in that long lake, the same lake I told you the story about the muskie in last summer. Well, I catch this real nice 17-inch fish. It jumped like crazy 4, 5, 6 times on the way in. Nice 17-inch fish. Looked completely like a smallmouth bass, but it's brown. And this friend of mine says he thinks it's called a bronzeback bass or a brown bass. It looked exactly like a smallmouth.
It was a smallmouth. I mean, they depending on the water they're in, the degree of staining, the substrate, and so forth, there's some variation in bass color from what you might think of as the typical kind of greenish, grayish, black. Bronzeback is a name you'll see in the outdoor journals and whatnot of just a big old smallmouth bass, a big old bronzeback. And, you know, I've caught them in different waters where they'll be almost a bronze brown, very iridescent to more. So what you caught was a smallmouth bass. There's just some variation in color depending on the lake. And I think the bigger, older fish tend to get a little darker and kind of different staining, too.
Yeah.
Well, this guy must have had a few years on him because it was a nice 17-inch plus.
That's a nice one.
Nice, chunky, smally. I was very happy to catch it. And it's fun to watch him jump, you know, like that. That's really fun. I mean, here we're catching, little shake-em-off-the-hook northerns and looking for a few big ones. And here I got this nice fish. And I looked at it for a while and looked at it. I said, boy, that looks, my fishing partner, I said, that really looks like a smallmouth, but I've never seen one that color.
It was.
It was. Okay. And actually, in Long Lake has some nice smallmouth population there, I admit. So, frankly, more smallmouth than a lot of people on the lake would like to have. They would prefer the walleye.
I'm not. I guess we're not giving away much information by saying Long Lake because the DNR was just promoting a new feature on their new website called Find a Lake.
Yeah.
So you could find out where there were boat ramps and other amenities and how deep the lake was and the contour. And I think they said that Mud Lake, Bass Lake and Long Lake were the three most common names, and between the three of them, probably 300 lakes in Wisconsin that were either Mud Lake, Long Lake, or Bass Lake.
Yeah, if it was Long Lake, I think that Bob referred to was the one that I fish from time to time, because I remember his question about the muskie. Bob, thank you so much. I want to give some others a chance to join in. Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dave Potratz, our on-air producer.
Hi, this is Ben Marins, host of At Issue. Hoping you'll join me today when we'll talk about a top news story of the day, starting at 4. And then after 5, I'll hold our monthly job line. A check of the economy, job hunting tips, but mostly a chance for job seekers and employers to meet. It's all At Issue later today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Taking your questions today on Wisconsin wildlife, Larry Mueller with our guest, Scott Craven, wildlife ecologist. Now, and you're still a UW wildlife ecologist. You'll be an emeritus professor. So
I have emeritus status, and I maintained PI status on some of my grants and whatnot. So the reality is, yes, although I've retired, I had not planned on retiring until January at the earliest. So I've got some things scheduled for the next few months, as well as the radio program. So hey, I just couldn't walk away. I've been going to that same building nearly every day for 39 years, and
that's a long time.
It was just pretty creepy to just walk out the door.
Oh, man. Tammy in Green Bay emailed us. For several years, there have been a pair of mallards in my Green Bay backyard, middle of a residential neighborhood. This year, they've been around since April. While the neighbors enjoy our friendly ducks and they enjoy coming to us for corn, we're wondering if they do not have a nest. As they do visit our yards for long periods of time, and we haven't seen any ducklings. Any insight on the habitat and habits for our wildlife companions? What should humans do or not do? We had that same situation on our home on Lakeshore Court.
Well, lots of folks end up with a pair of nesting ducks, you know, in a planter or a garden or under a shrub by the front door or whatever, and that's a little easier to advise on, because, you know, let things take their course. And if you're lucky enough to catch the ducklings literally as they're hatching, they're only in the nest until they all hatch and they're dry, and boom, then they're gone. And the ducks are pretty good at finding a way to water. They can be assisted by people. But in this case, a pair that's been coming regularly throughout the spring and summer may not have nested and may have lost the nest to predators or whatnot, not re-nested. There are lots of explanations. I've got a rooster pheasant and a hen that have been in the backyard now. He's been crowing incessantly since, I think, early April. He's getting hoarse, but he still crows a little bit in the morning. But we see the hen with him occasionally, and she didn't have a brood. So
too bad.
It just happens that some birds don't successfully nest or don't nest at all. And if they're visiting the yard, whether there's 2 or 20, eventually the folks involved have to decide whether things are getting to be too numerous and there are problems with droppings or noise or disturbance or whatever else. And then you eliminate the attraction and things go back to a more normal state. But if they're enjoying it, then no harm, no foul. No pun intended.
No, I was going to say.
And of course, this leads to bigger issues, like community-wide issues with waterfowl populations.
Geese.
like geese that we're going through here in the Madison area. And, of course, there's been a fair number of letters to the editor and other types of communication following up on the headline news of a week or 10 days ago that approval had been granted to actually euthanize or kill several hundred geese that have been deemed to be an unacceptable nuisance around some of the city parks, particularly Warner and several others. And you know, it's one of those things. If the problem is too many geese, the solution is fewer geese. And if there are no good rapid turnaround or reasonable length turnaround techniques to get there, short of physically removing some geese, then there are really few options. I know there are many people who would like to think that there are good ways to deal with this problem, but many, many communities across the United States have dealt with it. And many of them come to the same conclusion, that they simply have to remove some of those birds. And there are many programs going on where birds are removed and processed, essentially like domestic poultry. And the protein garnered from that operation goes back into the food network for the needy, or homeless, whatever, people who can use the protein. And ultimately, hopefully, the problem's solved and some people get what they need by way of foodstuffs. So I was just surprised to see that particular thing make front page news with several hundred geese involved when, you know, Canada geese are widely hunted across the continent. Here in Wisconsin, I don't have an exact figure on the harvest, but it's certainly in the tens of thousands of birds legally shot during the fall hunting season, and hardly an eyebrow is raised, and yet a couple hundred birds to solve what I view as a serious dilemma. Yeah. All of a sudden, it's a crisis. It's hard to, well, human nature is human nature.
Dennis and Toma, we're on to you now. Hi, Dennis.
Morning, gentlemen.
Morning.
Can you tell me what the latest alleged sightings of a cougar in Juneau County are at this time?
Are you going back, Dennis? It was many months ago that there was allegedly some problems with a cougar. I think a horse or two was injured and some other problems, and they were trying to do some trapping and tracking and a whole host of other things. Is that the genesis of your comment?
Yes, sir. In fact, I read an article here recently in the Foxy Shopper here for Monroe County, and there's a gentleman in there that puts in a outdoors news article, and he had a two-part article about the continuing attacks of supposedly a cougar in Juneau County. One particular horse, I believe, was attacked five times. And, mm-hmm. You know, stuff like that. And,
well,
alluded to that, there was a permit to hunt this cougar issued by the DNR. So, you know, that's. I was just curious to see, as if the DNR has finally. They'll never admit it, but whether or not they've attuned to the fact that there is a very good possibility that there is a cougar out in Juneau County.
Well, all right, Dennis, let's go back to the beginning. I recall the flurry of information about the horse attacks and so forth, and I know that both, it's not just the DNR in this case, it's also USDA's Wildlife Services people who are involved in this kind of investigation. And it was my impression that after the investigation and whatever other work they did in the area, that their conclusion was, in fact, this probably was not a cougar. And since that point, and this was quite some time ago, I haven't heard a peep or seen anything in kind of the loop of wildlife information that anything was still going on there. It may well be going on. And these days, with cougars moving around and the verified sightings and records and pictures and so forth that we've had over the past two or three years, I wouldn't discount the possibility of a cougar sighting in any county in the state at any time. Whether there is one, was one, or is still one in the Juneau County area, I can't say. All I can tell you, Dennis, is I've not heard a thing about it recently, and it was my impression that there was some amount of skepticism that what had been going on there was a cougar to begin with. That's all I can tell you.
No, there you go. Thank you for calling, Dennis. Appreciate your call. And we had, well, let's see, we can go from cougars to black bears. Caller was wondering if you had heard about a black bear cub near Mauston, Wisconsin.
No, but there are black bear cubs all over the place right now. Given the numbers of bears we have and the time of year, black bear cubs will not be a scarce commodity anywhere in the northern two-thirds of the state and probably even a few south of that.
Yeah. Beverly and Muskego, on to you now. Hi, Bev.
Hello to you. We've had vultures travel through many years across our farm, and this year I have three vultures that stayed. I would like to know the life cycle of the vulture, where they nest in Wisconsin or where they winter. Right now I have three on my barn.
Oh.
Well, I mean, they're kind of neat birds to watch. I was sitting in the front yard last night with my grandson, and there were three kind of soaring over the prairie. And I said, you watch those vultures, and you won't see them beat their wings at all. And he watched and watched until they disappeared from sight. Never once did one of them beat their wings. They were up in the wind, and they are very effective at that. So they are a native resident bird to Wisconsin. They do leave and head south in the fall and not winter in the state. They nest on the ground. Usually, I mean, the party line was they'd find a, you know, rocky crevice or ledge or something like that, the kind of place you'd expect to find in, say, the Baraboo Hills. But it seems like they've branched out a little bit and are found in other areas. So if they were going to nest elsewhere, it would probably be in a, well, if you've got anything that forms hillside rock outcrop or something like that, that would be the likely place. But everybody seems to be seeing them in most parts of the state right now.
Oh, good.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mike in Sparta, on to you. Hi, Mike.
Hi. Happy to be on the air. Hello, Larry and Scott. Say, I'd like to talk a little bit about bats. I know last year in the fall the DNR had some open forums around the state due to the concern about the white nose syndrome. Although Wisconsin is still clean, they're trying to protect the bats that we do have here, and they've proposed some new rules for bat proofers and construction people when there's maternity colonies of bats in buildings. Are you aware of some of those things?
Actually, we're going to be talking about that next Wednesday on the program with a DNR representative. But go ahead, Scott.
Who's coming over, Les?
Oh, I knew you were going to ask me that.
Is it Dave, Paul, both? Well, in any event, if the DNR folks are going to be here, Mike, you should probably hold off a bit. I'd say at the last hearings where I testified before the board on the rules package, most of the things that they were proposing dealt with protection in terms of minimizing the spread of white nose syndrome when it got here or preventing it from arriving as long as they could. So they were things like attempting to close access to some caves and mines that bats use as hibernacula, regulating the movement of people between these caves so that cavers, for example, would have to sanitize clothes, not use the same boots or not clean their boots between going from cave to cave, that kind of thing that dealt with equipment, clothing, and people, and the access to the caves themselves, as well as access for survey and monitoring purposes to keep track of white nose syndrome when and if it gets here. And I think most people feel that it will get here. In fact, some are surprised it hasn't turned up yet. Anyway, those were some of the rules. At the time, there was also another rule proposed that dealt with the notion of people trying to deal with household bat colonies and the bat proofers, the people doing bat work, that would have suggested that, wow, there was going to be some sort of oversight or permit needed for this kind of thing. And at the time, I testified that I thought, wow, this is this has the possibility of creating some pushback against bat protection if, in fact, it's perceived that the rules and regulations are making it more difficult or complicated for people to solve problems that probably have nothing to do with white nose syndrome since it's a winter issue and the bat proofing, of course, and most bat problems are warm season issues. And there was general agreement at that point that the rules package would be sent back to the folks working on it at the DNR in recognition of that point and attempting to make things easier. Now, I've not seen the final product, and if that's going to be rolled out or discussed next Wednesday, then you should ask again. But I did think it would be an issue for folks if it became more cumbersome for them to deal with a problem they're already very often very frustrated by and don't know what to do about. So I don't know what happened for sure. Perhaps my DNR colleagues who run the bat program are listening and one may call in. But in the meantime, if it's going to be covered next week, that'll be a good chance. Yep. Is that what you were concerned about?
That was my concern. And if it's Dave Riddell that you're going to have on next week.
Yes, that's who it is.
Yeah, Dave is real sharp on that. I think a public explanation on the air of those rules, possibly by Dave, would be just real significant.
As a matter of fact, it is Dave Riddell, who is now that you mentioned his name.
Dave was one of my grad students, a great guy and very, very dedicated and committed to bat conservation, but also well aware of what people have to face when dealing with bat problems. So I think he'll lay it out for you.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Marcia in North Bessemer, we go to you. Hi.
Hi. I'm sorry, I called for a different reason, but since he talked about retirement, My husband retired 5 years ago, and he says now that it's the best job he ever had.
Yeah.
I hope that proves to be the case.
Yeah, it took him about a year to get over 27 years of working, but he got over it finally. Okay, the reason why I called, you were talking about the rise in the cost of feed.
Yes.
Okay, we used to feed the deer.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a beautiful feeder right outside our patio door window, and I was paying $5 a week for a 50-pound bag of
corn.
Yes, yeah. Corn. And when it got up to $8, I told my husband, I said, I can't afford that anymore. Not that, and the sunflower seeds too, because they went up in price too. So we took the feeder down and. We just watch the deer as we can see them.
Yeah.
Well, I'm guessing, Martha, that you are certainly not alone. So
thanks
you know,
for
calling. The point, I guess, earlier that this could have an effect on what is put out on the landscape will probably be true.
Yep. Thank you again. Appreciate it very much. And we have Scott in Madison emailing. We saw two fish near the shore of Lake Wingra. One larger than the other that were engaged in elaborate circular dance, apparently mating. The larger one, male maybe, was the more aggressive, had large black dots on its gills that it would fold out to make them look like large eyes. The smaller fish went upside down and rubbed its belly against the underside of the larger fish. What kind of fish are these? Can you tell me about their... That's nothing that I have ever read about.
Well, I mean, I'm wondering what larger and smaller
means
in
is
this
a,
case.
Well, is a bluegill size, you know, when I heard the large dot, I thought bluegill.
Yeah, I would have thought bluegill, and they're the nesting cycle for many fish because of the weird spring and all of a sudden hot weather has been messed up, and some people still claim they haven't seen bluegill beds in some areas, so... That would be my guess. Up against shore this time of year, the really bigger stuff, you know, from muskie and pike to bass and whatnot, don't fit that description at all. So I've got to think of bluegill, but of course, this is the Madison area and Lake Wingra, and I could imagine all sorts of weird stuff being dumped in that lake. So you never know when there might be something really strange in there. But I'm guessing it was a pair of
betting bluegills,
but. Because that blue, that dark little spot on the gill plate of the male would look like an eye, I suppose. That would be my guess, Larry, nothing else.
Scott in Greenfield, on to you. Hi, Scott.
Hey, how you guys doing? I really enjoy the show. I tuned in halfway through the bat segment, but I have a question. At our cabin, we have a bat, well, actually two bats that I'm aware of that take up residency during the day to hide from the sun.
Mm-hmm.
One is in between the log of our cabin and, like, the log shutter where he seeks shelter, which I don't mind that he's there. The other question I have is that we have one underneath our covered porch, and just last weekend I saw him come out at dusk.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything I should be aware of, or should I just leave him be, or... that's pretty much what I'm wondering about, is just leave them be, and or should I kind of try to promote them out of there, shoo them away at dusk?
Well, that's really up to you. If they're not causing any particular problem, bats that are roosting outside the house under a shutter or a loose siding board or something like that, probably no big deal. It could be red bats, big brown bats, could be a couple different species. As long as you have no concern that they've got access to the attic or wall voids and that what you're seeing of a couple of bats could eventually turn into a bat colony inside, then that can get a little disruptive and be problematic. But if you, for example, in a covered porch, find a hole or a crack that communicates with interior space, then if that bat goes, that you're seeing, goes out to feed or whatever, I would close up that opening and make sure that that's not the start of something bigger and more problematic. If it's just hanging up on the porch, I have one that hangs up in a peak over our, this is kind of a little roof cover over our back access to our cabin in Price County, and the bats are hanging up there just resting during the night, but there are a lot of droppings accumulating on the steps. So if that becomes troublesome, I'll just put some plastic up, staple it up on the wood surface that they're able to hang from. They won't be able to hang there then, and that will be the end of that problem. So there are several ways to deal with it, but just the occasional bat under a shutter or whatever, I wouldn't worry about it too much.
Wouldn't worry about it.
No. Right. I'm not too concerned about the one under the shutter. It's the one under the porch that my wife's not too fond of, actually. And he's kind of underneath the exterior wood in the metal roof that covers our front porch on our cabin. And, you know, I saw him come out, and I told her not to worry about it. And I just, you know, wanted to find out if there's anything I should be concerned about. There is a few droppings down below. Other than that.
Well, do you live there year-round?
No.
Well, my suggestion is that you leave well enough alone for the next couple of months. Once it gets cold and you're up there on a nice fall day, October, November, pretty sure the bats have cleared out by then just go up where you see that bat coming and going and eliminate any space there. You can do it with something like expandable foam insulation.
Yeah,
you
sure.
can do it with steel wool, with bat insulation. You can use bubble gum if you want to. I mean, bats will not chew their way in or out of anything, and they won't expand an opening. They don't have the physical capability to do that. So if you just plug that up, come next spring, that problem should be gone.
Mm-hmm. Sure. So have you said it again? They will not chew. They
no.
don't utilize the spaces
no.
available.
They'll
right.
just utilize an available crack or opening. Okay. They don't have the capability of doing anything more than that.
Okay. Well, I think I'll just let them be then because I welcome them. So thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Let me see here. Peter in Marathon County, we'll get to you. Hi, Peter.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I got a tip for folks who want to try and control that moth worm that is eating their bird seed and their flour and cornmeal and rice, which is freeze it. When you get it, bring it home from the store, put it in your deep freeze if you have space. You don't have to keep it frozen, but those animals or critters cannot stand being frozen.
Right. Especially the sudden change in temperature is what does them in. They don't have time to adapt.
It's worked for me. And I wanted to also put in a plug here. I got this tip watching a movie in an agricultural journalism class on film taught by Fritz Albert, whom I'm sure you both know.
Oh, yes.
Right there on Henry Mall, fellas. So go Aggies.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have more callers online here, and we'll get to those callers. I have some other questions, too, relating to grouse and some other things. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, Larry Mueller here. Scott, we have some good news to report, at least on a couple of fronts, one grouse for sure.
Yes, some unexpectedly good news on the rough grouse front and on the duck and waterfowl front, and a little less good news on the turkey front, but not exactly a disaster by any means. On the grouse front, you know, as I think most people realize, rough grouse tend to cycle in terms of their population. Mm-hmm. It's roughly a 10-year interval between high populations, and those high populations are usually in years that end or in a 9 or a 0. So kind of everybody's thinking in terms of the grouse hunting community and people interested in grouse, especially in the North Country, were thinking that we'd seen the best of it a year or two ago, and that the expectation was we're going to start a slide here down into low populations for a few years. But lo and behold, the grouse threw us a curveball. When the drumming count information began to come in this spring, it seemed baffling that, oh my gosh, people are reporting, you know, as many grouse as they've ever heard on their survey routes in some places. And there was some speculation, oh, this is just a phenomenon related to the weather, or it's just us, or whatever. Bottom line, when everything was in and the numbers were crunched and they checked with Minnesota and neighboring states and so forth, Lo and behold, the grouse, which were expected to decline, went the other way.
Yeah.
And in fact, the overall, I think the overall upswing was somewhere in the neighborhood of 30% range, but central Wisconsin, 31% up. The so-called North Woods, 43% up.
That's amazing.
And in the Southwest, and remember, there's been lots of concern over the years. Whatever happened to the grouse in southwestern Wisconsin? Southwest was up 118%. Now, mind you, a doubling of four grouse is still not very many grouse, but a 43% increase in the heart of grouse range in the North Country.
That's big.
Is big. And boy, there was lots of enthusiasm up there when I was up poking around last weekend with people already starting to rub their hands together thinking, holy cow, going to be a good year. And the duck front, that also is very good news. Waterfowl numbers two are up, both here in Wisconsin and in the prairie duck factories of the northern prairie states and the prairie provinces of Canada. Mallards in Wisconsin are about at average, but wood ducks and the teal, and those are the four species that comprise most of our harvest, were up dramatically. And the word started to come in late last week that overall duck breeding numbers in the heart of duck range in the central part of the continent, it might be the highest that they've ever had since records were kept.
Wow.
And the upshot of this is that duck numbers look equally as fantastic as grouse numbers. So for folks who are interested in watching these birds or just knowing they're out there or just interested in good news on the wildlife front, not to mention the hunting community, that's pretty good news.
Yeah, excellent news. Turkeys down
a little turkey, bit. The turkey harvest dropped about 16% from last year. And, of course, recall that since turkey hunting started, in 83, I think, it had been almost year after year after year of successive increases in the harvest. Well, now we're starting to go the other way, and I think the explanations deal with several things. First of all, a string of two or three pretty lousy winters as far as turkeys were concerned, with either deep snow, extreme cold, or both. And then some lousy spring weather. So the bottom line is, and as we were talking this spring, I remember numerous callers saying, I'm just not seeing as many turkeys as I did. I think there were less turkeys for several different reasons. And that was reflected in a harvest that probably reflected both less turkeys. And as you recall, you hunt too. It was pretty miserable weather the first couple of hunting periods. So those two things combined, the harvest was still over 40,000 birds. So considering that they're still a relatively new thing in Wisconsin as far as turkey hunting, it's still fantastic, but it did take a downturn.
Becky and Juno, we are on to you now. Hi, Becky.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks for calling.
Good. I actually live between Rio and Cambria, and we had a neighbor boy stop the other day and tell us that he hit a badger by our place, but he didn't kill it because he got out and looked and he couldn't find it. But he was holding his hands about 2 to 2.5 feet apart, saying it was huge. And he said he felt like he hit a rock, which kind of makes sense to me. Would a badger be that big? And then, you know, there must be a den around somewhere. What should we be looking for if we want to see if there's more of them?
They'd easily be 2 feet long, and they're very low, heavy-set, squat animals. I could see a description of hitting one being like hitting like a rock. They're a sizable animal and pretty powerful, and they're found across the state, not in large numbers, but one could turn up just about anywhere. If you're looking for the den, and there probably is one around, look for a pretty good-sized hole in the ground and a lot of dirt moved around, probably in a hillside, a road cut, something like that. Not going to be the easiest thing in the world to find, but you might stumble across it by accident. But most encounters with badgers are unfortunately seeing one dead along the road or something like that, as opposed to seeing a live one.
Yeah, I did see one down the road a half a mile or so, mile ago, maybe, a couple of years ago, and the den opening, and I saw the badger going into it, was in a roadside ditch on the field side. So what would an adult, a male adult, run for size or length?
We've got several mounted ones in our collection in the office, and I would say that they don't have much of a tail. It's kind of a sorry-looking tail, but from nose to back end, A good 2 feet.
Good 2 feet, yeah.
Good, okay. Well, I'm sure that's what he saw then.
But, you know, most people, it's not the size, it's not the shape, but it's that black and white facial pattern that everybody's come to recognize with the university and whatnot that most people comment on. Otherwise, the only big fat squat animal that's running around pretty regularly is big old groundhog.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we recognize those pretty much. But I think it's the excitement because we don't see a badger every day.
No, no one does. Right. I've not seen. I've been in the state for 40 years now, and I've not seen a live one yet.
Ah, okay. Well, then we're one up.
There you go.
There you go. Thanks a lot, Becky, for calling. David from Appleton emailed, found a nest of rabbits in the fence and a fenced-in garden. The fence was 2 feet high. The female continued to jump the fence to care for the babies. After seeing the rabbits, the next day the nest was empty. Did not look like it was attacked by a predator. Could the female have moved the babies by jumping the fence with the babies? I found this strange and wanted to know your thoughts.
Well, I guess we'd have to know how baby the babies were. If they were, you know, naked and eyes closed, then they didn't leave on their own. But if they looked like little rabbits and their eyes were open and so forth, it may have just been time for them to be weaned and they simply cleared out. So not knowing
they could have jumped over a 2 foot fence.
Well, I think they'd have gone through it. It's much more common for rabbits to try and go through as the one that was stuck in your fence tried to do, or go under it. Jumping even, you know, generally, we've always preached that rabbit guard fences or other types of rabbit fencing, 18 to 24 inches high, as long as they're tight to the ground, are pretty darn effective.
Yeah.
So the, I don't know what to say about the jumping issue, but I think if the nest didn't look disturbed, the rabbits probably were weaned and left on their own.
And Terry in Menasha, on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I live right next door to Appleton where those rabbits were, and I was calling about foxes. I live on Doty Island, which is surrounded by water, and the access is by four bridges. And I saw a fox on our block, and it made me start to wonder, you know, if you see one, there must be a population there. It was very scruffy, and I thought, you know, well, is it trapped on the island? Maybe it came here on the ice and kind of trapped, or maybe there's a population here and that's what helps keep our bunny population down a little bit. My daughter lives in Nina, and I think they have about 10 times the number of rabbits that we do.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot, but can you tell me about foxes, and do you think we do have a population here?
Well, the fact that it's an island is pretty much irrelevant. The foxes would cross those bridges pretty easily. And you may have a resident. How many homes, for example, on this? Are we talking about hundreds of acres or just a fairly small island?
I don't know how to answer that. I would think it's about 10 football fields big. I'm not sure.
Plenty of room for a fox family. And, you know, surely in somebody's backyard or a park space or a greenway or along the water shoreline or whatever, those foxes find a suitable den under somebody's garden shed or deck or whatnot, they would do just fine there. And from a fox's perspective, lots of rabbits, lots of pet food lying around, no coyotes to hassle them, relatively quiet place. Good spot for a red fox. And this time of year, they do look pretty skinny and motley
scruffy,
looking. But
yeah.
I think that fox would do just fine there. How many there are, who knows. But there certainly could be a pair and ultimately a family.
Yep.
Very cool. Thanks. And I just want to mention one peculiar sighting. My daughter and I were driving south on the highway, and we saw what looked like a woodchuck sitting on top of a fence post on the side of the highway, like a red, you know, like a red-tailed hawk would do.
Yeah.
But it was like a woodchuck.
Yeah.
And it was very strange.
Well, that is a little odd, but the reality is woodchucks are just big, fat ground squirrels, and they climb very well.
Yeah.
So they will routinely forage up in trees for tender young foliage and whatnot. It looks strange. And I suppose I could see one, you know, hey, the vegetation's kind of thick. I'll go up this fence post and have a look around. I've certainly not seen one in that posture, but certainly possible.
Yep, there you go. Thanks, Terry, for calling. And Kyle from Milton emailed, our cabin is in Douglas County, and we saw a bear with four cubs.
Wow.
I've only seen three cubs. I've never seen four. He was wondering how common are four cubs.
It's pretty unusual. I mean, it happens. It happens, but it's an outlier.
Yeah.
Maybe that's why we've got so darn many bears. Big litters.
I don't know. And Joe from the town of Grant emailed to say, I read in the paper that turtle season is open. Can you talk about that? I'm not sure.
Turtle season opens, I think, the 15th and then runs into the fall. And that's for the harvest of unprotected species. So let's see. It would be wood turtle, blanding turtle, and box turtle because they're endangered or threatened, can't be taken. But all the other turtles are fair game, although really the ones that this is targeted at are the two soft shells and the snapping turtles, on which there are bag limits, and those are actually harvested for the meat in the Mississippi River and other big bodies of water where they're common, although it also becomes for unprotected species like painted turtles and so forth after the 15th, presumably after the nesting season. One could be picked up, although we certainly don't. You know, the meat harvest, the commercial harvest and all is one thing. For the other species that have no particular food value, sure, yeah. Pick one up, have a look at it. I jumped off the dock on Sunday, much to the pleasure of everybody watching, when a painted turtle swam by, and it went into the lily pads, and so did I, and I dove underwater and pursued it like an otter and finally caught it.
And showed it to people
and put it right back where it came from.
Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, our guest Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking the world of wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. And Scott, we have Farm Technology Days. You're going to be at Farm Technology Days coming up pretty quickly here.
Next week. The show setup is Monday. The show's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. It's up in Waupaca County, not too far from Marsh. Well, no, I'm trying to think now. Is it? Well, it's in Waupaca County in any event. It's an easy thing to find if people are interested in going out. Quite a show as far as the farm community is concerned. And we will once again have a booth in the Progress Pavilion tent. I'll only be there on Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Jamie will be manning the booth on Tuesday. And David and I on Wednesday and David on Thursday. So the bottom line is there'll be folks there to talk wildlife throughout the show. And then I'll be leaving Wednesday and going directly from the show up to Minocqua to Kemp Station on Lake Tomahawk. And at 7 o'clock Wednesday night, that's Wednesday the 13th, I'll be doing a fireside wildlife program at Kemp Station for folks. I know if we're talking about anything to do with the Northwoods, loons or eagles or bears or whatever, we get lots of callers from the Lakeland area. So here's kind of an invitation.
Right.
If you're in the Lakeland area, live there or just happen to be there, if you've never seen Kemp Station, the university's facility on Lake Tomahawk, as you know, Larry, it's a beautiful place. There's a beautiful fire ring, and we'll be hanging out there from 7 to whenever, doing kind of a fireside chat on current wildlife issues and concerns and whatnot. So free and open to the public, almost like the radio program in person. But if you think you might be interested, you do need to call Kemp. I just listened to Carla's message this morning. The number there at Kemp is 358-5667, and you can call and just essentially register over the phone and say, yeah, three of us are coming out, or five, or 10, or 110, whatever, and we'll have a good time, assuming it's a nice evening. It's just a beautiful spot, and we'll talk about all things wildlife next Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at Kemp.
And that's, what's the area code on that for people who might be driving
715.
Up? 715 area code.
Yep.
715-358-5667.
Yes.
What a great way to spend an evening. And Jim in Milton has a question for you, Scott, so let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I just had a question in regard to the amazing comeback that the bald eagle seems to be making in this area.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a large animal veterinarian, so I'm on the road quite a bit in the area from, like, Godhead up Fort Atkinson, Whitewater area. And, you know, we've been seeing eagles along the Rock River here for quite a few years during the winter. But I have a a horse farm near Fort Atkinson 2 years ago. They had one flying around quite a bit during the winter, two last year, and now they have a successful nesting this year. Mm-hmm. I just think that's pretty amazing. Is there a lot more of that going on than what I'm aware of?
There's a lot more of it going on all over the place in places where people haven't seen eagles for years, never expected to see eagles. There's a pair nesting in a pine tree out in Iowa County on the Trout Creek Valley near where I have hunted deer for years, and we never thought we'd see an eagle there, let alone a nesting eagle. So, yes, it's one of many great success stories as far as wildlife conservation in Wisconsin, and in the case of the eagle, all across the northern tier of states, well, across the country, really.
Yeah, really.
Eagles have just made a terrific comeback after some of the threats to their success due to pesticides in the environment were eliminated. And I think that, coupled with education and a little bit of good luck thrown in, eagles have done very well.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Marlene in Manitowoc. On to you now. Hi, Marlene.
Hello. I have a question for you about a noise I hear. We've got quite a bit of woods behind us. I get home late at night, early in the morning from my job, and it's kind of a small screeching noise, and I wondered if that was owls or... I hadn't noticed it before, and we've been here quite a while. There's about 30, 40 acres of woods behind us.
Well, I mean, it certainly could be a screech owl, but it could be a number of things. A screeching noise is sort of hard to... It's sort of hard to build on. So, you know, short of a recording or something like that, or hearing it in person, noises.
I could make the noise for you.
All right, we'd love to hear that. I was kind of hoping you would.
Okay, it is kind of like.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow. I've been working on it.
Oh, good. You know, I still think owls a possibility, but there are a few other birds. There are a lot of other things that make night sounds.
Yeah.
And especially as it begins to warm up, there are even some of the larger insects that make some pretty weird, persistent. Do you hear that? Does this go on all night, or does this seem to be something that happens when you're getting home?
I'd say it's going on between 1 and 3, and then pretty much by that time I'm calling it a night.
But, can't blame you for that.
Yeah.
I just can't tell you for sure what it is. However, there are many sites where you can go on online, especially for the birds. And I think if you did a little Google work on night sounds and things like that, there are lots of recordings of these kinds of things.
Screech
I think if you do
sound.
A little Google, start with the likely suspects like screech owl or a couple of other owls like young barred owls and so forth, and see as you listen if you hear something that rings a bell.
May I ask you a question about frogs as well?
Sure.
Okay. I know every summer you see, I'll be driving home at night and I'll see just frogs, you know, the roads littered with frogs. And I always thought, what is there a certain time that these are coming out? Sometimes there's some real big toads mixed in with them.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's nothing you can do but you're going to run over some of them. But I'm sure they're mating or something. But
well, there are a couple things going on. The first big flush of frog movement, and it occurs periodically from really very early spring until midsummer, relates to some of the species going from where they happen to spend most of their time to where they're breeding, to the breeding ponds and backwaters and roadside ditches and whatnot. Some of the larger species, like green frogs, for example, and bullfrogs, which are singing now, are permanent residents in the water. So they're not necessarily making that movement. Then the next big movement occurs when all the tadpoles resulting from all that breeding activity metamorphose into frogs, and then the new frogs are headed out cross-country from the breeding locations. And then throughout the season, when you get a nice, warm, rainy night, the frogs are on the move anyway, crossing the road from ditch to ditch or from pond to pond, and you see large movements of, especially if you're in a wetland complex or a big wet open space, leopard frogs in particular are notorious for lots of them moving around the landscape.
Oh, interesting. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And we have, let's see, we've got an email from Ken who says in the Kakana area, Sunflower seeds have doubled in price, and the bag is now $40 versus the old 50 pounds bag size. Lady at the hardware store blamed the price increase on the current high cost of transportation. Bottom line is, I will no longer be feeding birds. This is a tough decision after having feeding birds for more than 35 years.
Well, that's kind of scary, Larry. Yeah. I'd made the same observation. I looked closely at one bag that said, oh, that's a little more reasonable price. And it's only 40 pounds. It's the old candy bar trick. They're still 49 cents. They're just smaller. That's unfortunate to hear. But I suspected when we talked about that earlier that we'd hear it from some folks, and we are.
And we have Mark in Green Bay.
I should just say, I guess my thoughts on that, in terms of someone trying to decide whether to cut back or not, if the price of seeds are causing you some anxiety, I think there are a couple of ways to cut back with the least impact on bird populations. One is to cut back on summer feeding. That's not absolutely necessary.
Right.
That's more of something people do for their own value. And the other thing to do is, I have nothing to back this up, but my suspicion is that as far as winter feeding is concerned, that you'd probably be better off to figure out what you're willing to pay for sunflower seeds and then ration those out over the course of the season, so that maybe you put, you know, 2 cups or 2 pounds or whatever in your feeders in a given morning.
Yeah.
And when it's gone, it's gone. But you fill them up again the next day or every other day, rather than buying a bag of seed, you know, feeding for a month and a half or 2 months and then saying, oh, the heck with it, and then leaving the feeders empty for the rest of the winter. I think the former issue of parceling it out over the course of the feeding season would be more fun for you and probably better for the birds.
We had a couple of Facebook questions or comments. Laura saw an albino, partially albino American robin this morning. Very cool. Albinism in birds, is it fairly common, she wonders?
No. It's a fairly rare occurrence in any form of animal, whether it's albino deer or albino robins. A neat thing to see, an anomaly that most people don't see, but certainly not something I'd call common.
And also a comment from Karen, are red squirrels particularly destructive to human homes?
Red squirrels entering, say, a cabin closed up for the winter can be very destructive, as can any squirrel. Gray squirrels are probably the most notorious, red squirrels right up there with them. But even flying squirrels, cute as they are, if they get into an attic or wall voids, then the insulation on wiring is at risk, the thermal insulation is at risk, the thermal security of the house as they make holes and whatnot in and out is at risk. Not a good thing. You should not, as cute as they are, put up a nest box, feed them outside, but make sure your house is generally animal-proof. There's really no reason to share your home with any of these birds or mammals.
And Steve posted on our Facebook page a correction. Farm Technology Days is in Marathon County.
Oh, okay.
Just north of Marshfield.
There we go.
So we wanted to get that in. And Mark in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Oh, hi, Larry. Hi, Scott. Before I ask my question, I'd ask for a chance for a follow-up and a debate on this, because my point is probably somewhat controversial here.
Oh, we love that.
There you go. I think the DNR is about to make a really colossal mistake. They're going to defoliate 118 miles of shoreline, 3,800 acres, in the attempt to control Phragmites grass. Now, I can understand the need to take it out in places where it's obstructing people's view of the bay or their access to the bay, but to have whole-scale defoliation of such a large area over a three-year period is going to result in an amazing decrease of wildlife habitat. I mean, their canard is that the native swamp or marsh plants are going to come back after these are removed. I know that's not going to happen. Below the ordinary high water mark with Lake Michigan Huron coming up, that doesn't happen. They need to be on an exposed bed. So what have you heard about the program? Is there any way to get any input? There was no environmental assessment done, and there were no public hearings done before the word came out from on high that they're going to have this program going.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure how much of a debate we're going to be able to create here, because I simply don't know anything about this program you're referring to. I know they've been worried about Phragmites as well as a number of other invasive species along the shoreline. And I ran into a crew in Door County a few years ago when I was up there for a program, and they were kind of doing spot treatment where they were bundling and treating individual clumps or clusters of plants. I'm not sure what to say, except that usually, I have a great deal of faith in the natural areas managers, and these are probably folks in the Bureau of Endangered Resources rather than the Bureau of Wildlife Management. So that's where I'd try and go for some information. And there would be a regional ecologist from the Bureau of Endangered Resources in Green Bay. Excuse me, that's where I'd start and try and get the background information you're interested in. I'm almost certain that they've considered both the implications of letting the Phragmites take over, as it has in many areas, as opposed to perhaps the short-term, what they, I'm sure, view as the short-term loss in terms of the defoliation, if it means that ultimately there'll be a chance to restore some of the native vegetation. So whether it's the efforts to control purple loosestrife or Phragmites or a host of other plants that are causing problems like that, all I can say is that these things are pretty well thought out, and the implications are studied, and sometimes you do have to bite the bullet for a period of time until things begin to reverse themselves, and that's all really all I can say about it. I would suspect that there has to have been opportunity for public hearing or comment on this kind of thing. I just don't know when or where it occurred. But I'd start with the regional ecologist from the Bureau of Endangered Resources in Green Bay and go from there.
There you go. Thanks for calling. Appreciate it very much. We have Anne Marie and Gillette. We have found an especially effective method of discouraging raccoons and bears from hanging around our place and doing damage. We serve them grape jam with cayenne pepper sandwiches, sort of, heavy on the cayenne. Like about a quarter inch thick on the jam. Two attempts is the most they will try before deciding to go elsewhere.
Well, if it works, you know, that's fine. It's the basis of some commercial products like Squirrel Scram, which is a cayenne pepper additive that goes into birdseed to potentially deter squirrels, and the actual chemical that makes these peppers hot is called capsaicin, and it's an active ingredient in a number of commercial repellents. So if you're getting good success, probably no, I'm sure it's a little uncomfortable for the coon or bear, but that's the purpose. They get uncomfortable enough that they don't want to repeat the process. So what the heck?
There you go. Mary went on our Facebook page and asked, do all the elk have that we have in Wisconsin have big yellow collars around them?
No, I don't believe all of the elk have collars, but there's certainly a good proportion of the herd that for monitoring and protection purposes, and I think for purposes of moving the, they're attempting to establish some other areas not too far from the core area of elk to try and improve the production of the herd a bit. Yes, there are some marked elk in the herd, but I don't think by any means all of them are marked.
Terry and Mercer, we are on to you now. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I wanted to call and share a project that's going on in the Northwoods area. You know, we have a long-term ecological research site at Trout Lake that's run by the UW.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists there got a grant from the National Science Foundation a couple of years ago, and we've created a traveling art and science exhibit on the future of lakes. One of the things that's in that is a beautiful loon sculpture by an artist from Bayfield named Jim Ramsdell. But this exhibit is traveling. In fact, it made me think of it when you talked about your program at Kemp next week, because on Thursday, that art exhibit is going to have an opening reception at the Campania Center in Minocqua. And this exhibit is traveling around the Discovery Center in Northwoods, Nicolet College, Trees for Tomorrow. And what we're trying to do is find a new way of communicating the science about how our lakes are changing with citizens.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm thinking folks who are listening here would be interested in this. And one of the things that's really neat is this is part of a national long-term research network, and they're starting to look at using the arts and humanities as a way of communicating this complicated data to the public.
Oh. Well, it sounds like a great idea. Is the exhibit, is there a planned circuit for it now over the next few months, or is it possible that groups who might be interested in having it displayed somewhere could make contact and have that done?
There is plans up through the fall, mm-hmm. and then it's possible that the exhibit could keep going if there were some places that were interested.
Okay.
We do have a Facebook page and a website. The title of the show is called Drawing Water, Artists and Scientists Explore Northwoods Lakes. And so you can go on Facebook and put in Drawing Water, or go to the UW Trout Lake Research website, which is a phenomenal research site that shows all sorts of data they've collected there. And we have a page there that talks about all the art and science and the schedules on there. But
okay.
The first stop is going to be Minocqua, the Campania, and then on to the Discovery Center and Trees for Tomorrow. And
so that's on Thursday of next week?
Yes.
Okay, well, I'll not only is it going out here, but for whoever comes to talk with me at Kemp next Wednesday night, we'll mention that.
And it's John Bates is one of the co-coordinators. I know Larry's a good mm-hmm. friend
oh, yeah.
of his. Larry, yeah. we should do a show on this and get John to read some poems.
That sounds like a good plan. I haven't talked to John in a while.
So,
it'll be worth getting him back. Thanks a lot for calling, Terry.
Sure thing. Okay, yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Appreciate the call. All right, so lots going on up there in your neck of the woods next week.
It's a good place to be.
Yeah, it's a wonderful place.
I just hope it's a few degrees cooler than it is here in Madison. It seems like it's been a hot summer.
Beth in Madison, we're on to you now. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
There was some photos going around on the internet showing a mom bear with five cubs.
Mm-hmm.
And the photographer was able to take pictures of them when they were tiny little cubs, the cute age.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And again, months later when they were pretty good big bears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Five.
I think I actually saw some of those. But it, like the previous caller that had seen a sow with four, again, you start to get out to the extreme. I don't think I've ever heard of more than five, but you do certainly hear threes, fours, and fives, but that's a bit.
That's amazing.
That's out there on the extreme.
That's a lot to raise.
Interesting sidelight on the idea of sows with cubs. One of the things we probably won't get to now, but there was an interesting article in the recent Wildlife Professional, which is one of our professional journals, about an analysis of black bear attacks in North America over the last 50 or 60 years. And Pat Durkin picked up on that in the Sunday paper and talked about bears not being all that fearful of people anymore and talked about the implications of that. But the interesting thing in that, the bottom line relative to sows, is that the vast majority of the attacks, and not in Wisconsin, but in primarily in Canada and Alaska, were not sows protecting cubs, but rather subadult or adult male bears, a very high proportion of fatal attacks. So the authors commented that the old adage that, oh boy, don't get between a sow and her cubs, that's not a good idea to begin with, but it's not usually the result of it does not usually result in a fatal bear attack. Not that there are, I think there have only been 59 or 69 over 50 years on the whole continent. So not a huge issue unless you're one of the involved participants. But sows and cubs were not really the main cause of the problem.
Scott, always a pleasure. Thank you so much. Now, you will be missing us in August. We'll probably get somebody, one of your colleagues,
that's fine.
To join us. But then you're back September.
I'll be back in September and then on for...
Forever.
For however long it goes.
as long as I'm here, certainly. Scott Craven, retired UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist, who really isn't retired. He's still working. But he's officially retired. Let's put it that way. Unofficially, he's still working away, and he'll be back September. And we'll have another one of his colleagues from Wildlife Ecology join us. One or two join us next month in August. Tomorrow at 11, we talk with Jack Socha, who's got some tips on how to get the most out of your digital camera. And then at 11:45, Dustin Maher will tell us about surviving the dog days of summer through exercise. Stay with us.